Campus FM presents Work in Progress, a series of seminars and symposia on understanding cultural diversity.
This year's theme for Work in Progress seminars is understanding cultural diversity. We've had papers on asylum seekers, a symposium on illegal immigrants and refugees. We've had papers on understanding or increasing dialogue between Muslims and Christians. Most recently, Dr. Ivan Kalous looked at the implications for philosophy of the September 11th, 2001 atrocity in the United States, and more generally, the implications for philosophy and the humanities of terrorism. Today we begin the first of two seminars, which is devoted very specifically to the understanding of cultural diversity inside Maltese society and of racial difference inside Maltese society. And these two seminars are particularly concerned with perceptions, popular perceptions of racial and cultural difference inside the Maltese Islands. Next week, allow me to announce that there has been a change of venue. Next week, there is going to be a symposium organized by tonight's speaker, Dr. Adrian Grima, in Mediterranean Institute, room 122. That's Mediterranean Institute, room 122, the seminar behind a seminar room behind HSBC Bank. And this will be a general discussion of the clandestini experience, which is going to be inaugurated by two speakers. One is Mr. Norbert Buttigieg, who is himself a writer, and the other is Popo, who is from the Congo and began his period of stay here as himself a refugee. Tonight, Dr. Adrian Grima is going to be speaking specifically about recent Maltese literature and its understanding of cultural and racial difference. So tonight, in the first of these two seminars, we welcome Dr. Adrian Grima. He is a lecturer in Maltese at the Junior College of the University of Malta. He received his PhD in Maltese literature in 2003, last year. Quite apart from his academic activity, I think many of you know Dr. Grima as being very active in NGOs, such as Initiamed and the Third World Group. So over to you, Adrian. Thank you very much for addressing us on the topic, Despite Her Dark Skin, Her Face Was Attractive, Suppressing Identities in an Enlightened Malta.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Basically, I want to tackle, I think, about five issues. I want to start off with a small quote from Achebe about the innocence of stories, or the supposed innocence of stories, and the supposed innocence of reading. Then I want to reread some parts of Tahtlet Saltanet by Jose Aquilina, which is again in syllabus of the Maltese literature at intermediate level. Then I want to see what Aquilina is saying about slavery and what he's not saying about slavery, why he wants the British flag to fly over Malta. And then I want to end with another quote actually from somebody else, from Seamus Dean, and there to talk about decolonization and to see whether we can see this particular novel, and by implication other novels, as novels of decolonization. In a little book published in 2000, Chinua Achebe, the Nigerian writer, talks about his experiences. The book is called Home and Exile. It's not a theoretical book. It's more a book about his reminiscences. And he talks about when he read a particular novel called Mr. Johnson, and this particular novel, which is a colonialist novel, sort of brought home to him this lack of innocence, as it were, of stories. And he wrote something like this: What the book, Mr. Johnson, the novel, Mr. Johnson, did for me, though, was to call into question my childhood assumption of the innocence of stories. It began to dawn on me that although fiction was undoubtedly fictitious, it could also be true or false. Not with the truth or falsehood of a news item, but as to its disinterestedness, its intention, its integrity. Needless to say, I did not grasp all of this at one bound, but slowly over time, through the experience of life and reading. And reading came to mean ending with greater scrutiny and sometimes rereading with adult eyes what I had first read in the innocence of my literary infancy and adolescence. Saying this the way I have said it may well leave my reader with the impression that I became a sad and disillusioned old man whose joy in reading has been battered and bruised by the recognition that cruelty can be paraded in many disguises through the avenues of literature by all manner of dubious practitioners. I am glad to reassure everyone about my abiding faith in the profession of literature, and further to suggest that the kind of careful and even cautious mode of reading that I am impliedly advocating does not signal despair. Rather, it is the strongest vote of confidence we can give our writers and their work to put them on notice that we will go to their offering for wholesome pleasure and insight, and not for a rehash of old stereotypes which gained currency long ago in the slave trade and poisoned, perhaps forever, the wellsprings of our common humanity. As a writer, I am all for such challenge and such expectations from my reader. And I think this, it's quite a lengthy quote, actually. This says a lot about what I would like to say about Aquilina, because some may interpret the position I take in front of this novel, and others have taken, but not publicly, in front of this novel, as somehow an attack on the integrity of Aquilina as a writer. But of course, yeah, we're discussing his novel, and I think he deserves to be discussed. He deserves to be reread, I think, with the eyes of a person living in 2004 and not in 1935 when the novel was written, or in 1979. I'll come to this later on. In 1938, the Maltese writer and eminent linguist Giuseppe Aquilina published his classic novel called Tatlet Saltnit, Under Three Rains, that is now once again being studied by students at pre-university and university level. According to the latest edition, this book has been, in fact, reprinted five times, 1945, 1969, 1978, 1997, and 2003. No joke for a little island like ours. This is the edition I've been using, which is 78, and this is the very latest edition, which I will refer to later on. This is 2003. It was quite a year, 1938, for Maltese literature, because he finished writing the novel in 35 and published it 3 years later. It was quite a year for Maltese literature, with the publication of José Lul Mercer's Lelita Hazzair, José Galia's Mini Spagnoli, José Bonici's Il Awatal Imhabba, Ivo Muscata Zopardi's Tri Idei Anumrut Lettaj, and Gino Muscata Zopardi's Angelita Niged. Books of poetry published in that year included Duncarm's Elien Ulil Minnu, and Carmelo Vassallo's Nerien. Many of these books are alive and kicking. The novel is set in the turbulent years between the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th. One can enter this novel, as it were, which the author himself describes as a socio-historical novel, from various points. I have chosen one of the least prominent characters to highlight some aspects of the novel's ideology, or what I see as the novel's ideology. This is the Muslim slave Il Halwenio, who lives with the protagonist, Alessandro Abela, his sister, Bice, and their authoritarian mother, Baroness Isabella. in their house on the main street of the capital city of Valletta, close to the Grand Master's palace. In more ways than one, Inhaluen is an important figure. According to one of the Maltese characters, Indri the singer, Indri Lanay, despite her dark skin, her face was attractive. The overall picture of the slave is that of an inferior being. The narrator points out that she is known by her nickname, Ilhalwenia, because she lost her name when she lost her freedom as a child. As if no one were responsible for this loss of freedom, as if it were simply an instance of innocent bad luck. The narrator appreciates the slave's servile attitude. She speaks very little and she acts as if she were permanently indebted to those who own her. She respects Alessandro because he treats her kindly, but throughout much of this novel, his kindness doesn't change the essence of their master-slave relationship. The strong impression one gets from the novel is that what makes her inferior is not only the fact that she is a slave, but also the fact that she is a Muslim. The text doesn't harbor much respect for Muslims or even for Jews, not unless they convert, of course. Another Muslim slave in this novel is too thick to realize that people are pulling his leg. His stupidity and fearfulness make the Maltese patriot Gianni and the friendly knight Saint Beuve, who saved him from drowning, smile patronizingly. The Maltese text says, "Ich gust auch," as if he were a sweet baby. But this doesn't stop them from taking him away as their slave. And quoting from the text, the poor, my emphasis, Muslim, kept staring at them, dumbfounded. In another passage, which is clearly designed to be an important, emotionally charged moment in the story, Alessandro hugs Ilhalwenia and caresses her cheeks, Melsela Haddea, as if she were a little child. Before he hugs the slave, Alessandro embraces his sister Beecher, but there is no suggestion that he treats her as a child. It is true that many of the female characters in Maltese, male-dominated romantic literature, are weaklings that need and want the protection of men. But in the case of Ilhalwenia, she is doubly weak because she is a Muslim, not Catholic. Charles Briffa would probably read this particular scene of Alessandro caressing the slave as a sign of Alessandro's magnanimity. It is nothing of the sort. Alessandro treats the slave in a condescending manner. He caresses her like a little child because he treats her like a little child. In the same way that his companion Gianni, another patriot by the way, patronizes the Muslim slave that he saved from drowning. Briffa writes that Aquilina creates two, I'm quoting, important female characters in Baroness Isabella and Paulina, Alessandro's mother and spouse respectively. But like Ilhalwenia, they are nothing but flat characters. That is, characters endowed with one or very few traits of their own and highly predictable in behavior, capable and highly predictable in behavior, these flat characters. Round characters, on the other hand, as Ian Forster has told us, are complex, multidimensional, unpredictable characters who are capable of convincingly surprising behavior. Briffa also writes that Tatlet Saltnit describes, and this is a quote directly from something he wrote in English, describes the story of a hero and a heroine with remarkable fictional prose and powerful characterization. In reality, there are no round characters in this novel. Like Esther, the daughter of the miserly Jew, Ilhan Wenia is an attractive but vulnerable young woman who is fortunate enough to have the protection of an attractive young Maltese patriot who is inevitably male and Catholic. Both Esther and Ilhan Wenia fall in love with their Maltese protectors, and both end up assimilating to the dominant local Catholic culture. They identify themselves with the Virgin Mary and with Our Lady of Sorrows in particular, whom the Muslim slave describes as the woman or the mother with the pierced heart, Tal Alp Min Fuda. The narrator suggests that Ilhan Wenia didn't think of her love for Alessandro as that of a woman for a lover. This perhaps means that Aquilina doesn't allow Ilhan Wenia the ability to analyze her own feelings, because the text suggests that she is in love with him. Esther, the Jew, as the text often reminds us. On the other hand, marries Gianni at the same wedding celebration of Paulina and Alessandro, the protagonists of the novel. It's a Catholic marriage, of course. After the death of Baroness Isabella, Alessandro's mother, Ilhan Wenia decides to become a nun. Because she is essentially a good person, Aquilina cannot resist marrying her to the Catholic faith. After all, it's not her fault that she was born a Muslim. Now that she has the choice, it's only natural that she chooses the Catholic faith. Like Esther, she was attracted to the Virgin Mary immediately, and her conversion gave, and I'll quote the novel here, this angel's heart, the peace of Christ. But the novel seems to suggest that Ilhan Wenia's decision to become a nun is really dictated by the unrequited love she has for Alessandro. This is something really, I think, open to discussion, but I'll go ahead with this interpretation, which I stand by, of course. When she sees two nuns in the street run to the aid of a wounded young man who dies in their arms, she decides to leave her mistress's house and join them. Her last and only words to Beecher, the protagonist's sister, as she leaves, are for Alessandro. "Tell Alessandro that I have left because the mother of the pierced heart has called me. Tell him that I pray for him very much. Dots. Very much. Dots." Perhaps the dots are meant to imply that she thinks of him all the time, like Rosina in Wistine Bourne's novel Issaripta Fidda, The Silver Cross, which was published the year after, 1939. She has lost her protector lover forever, so she decides to devote herself to God instead, another male protector, so to speak. Ilhan Wenia's conversion to the Catholic faith, for which she asks Alessandro to help her, allows her to have a name even before she can obtain her freedom. The Catholic faith gives her an identity. Now she is someone. For the first time in the novel, she has something important to say, and Alessandro listens carefully. Her name, she tells him, is now Dolores, a name inspired by the figure of the woman of the pierced heart. Ever since she was baptized and she obtained her freedom, Dolores, whom the narrator continues to call Ilhan Wenia, became more and more like Beecher's sister rather than like a servant. The text seems to imply that the slave obtained her freedom as a result of her conversion to Christianity, to Catholicism. And in the meantime, Baroness Isabella, her owner, had died. But research by Maltese historians has shown that, contrary to what many people may think, baptism did not break the bond of slavery in Malta. Chaparra reports, for example, that the baptized slave Giuseppe Manoli, and this is fact, this is history, was kept in chains and was treated worse, here I quote, than a Turk or a renegade. all the inquisitors could do was to put pressure on the masters to give freedom to these neophytes. Freedom, confirms Wettinger in his book on slavery in the Maltese Islands, was not acquired by mere conversion. In fact, it rarely came to the converts. Where slavery was concerned, Maltese society at the end of the 18th century was a profoundly unjust society. At the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th, there was still a large number of slaves in the Maltese Islands. The most precious part of the booty of the corsairs sailing the seas of the Mediterranean was the slaves, for whom there was a constant demand from the Maltese, the knights hospitaliers, and foreigners living in Malta. In the 18th century, the supply of this human merchandise started to decline, and in 1757, for instance, the order's ambassador to Rome, Solaro, was commissioned to purchase 155 Turks caught by the papal galleys. According to historian Franz Chaparra, slaves were an ingredient of the Maltese social scene and were easily recognized by their shaved hair, except for a forelock and a chain around their ankle. Female slaves, and this of course links up to Il Halwenia, could wear the Maltese dress, the onnella, and some had tattoos on their forehead after the barbarian fashion, to quote. Apart from the government, many private persons had slaves. The upper classes kept them as servants, but the clergy and the merchants would generally own one too. And so did coach owners, painters, and masons. But with their fumigations, incense, candles, magical circles and numbers, charms, talismans, and potions, and their Arabic texts, the church authorities saw the Muslims as a real threat to correct Christian practice and true doctrine. On the other hand, Chaparra notes that several Christians made their way to North Africa, where they forsook their religion for the teachings of the Prophet. Apparently, Islamic society was seen as, quote, more open than the Christian. The corsair captain Andrea Ricciardi claimed that in the Levant there is no distinction of persons. Privilege of birth did not count in Muslim cosmopolitan cities such as Algiers and Tunis. But aside xenophobic sentiments, once a stranger became a Muslim, and many Christians condemned because of their birth to an inferior social condition in Christianity. Excuse me, I read this wrongly. Such cosmopolitan cities as Algiers and Tunis put aside xenophobic sentiments once a stranger became a Muslim. And many Christians condemned because of their birth to an inferior social condition in Christianity were provided with marvelous occasions of social advancement. Apostatizing could be a way to power and fortune, and renegades were to be found among all sections of society. The paper then talks further about this issue. I give an example of the Emperor of Morocco deciding to ransom all the slaves that were left in Malta in the last decades of the 19th century. The official end to slavery in Malta came quite unexpectedly. On 16th June 1798, Napoleon Bonaparte declared in writing that, quote, slavery is abolished. But there is no mention of this in Aquilina's novel, which presents Napoleon as an unreliable man and a despot with blood on his hands, I'm quoting. A view that contrasts sharply with the novel's unlimited admiration for the British. There is no doubt that this decree freed privately owned slaves as well as those who belonged to the order. However, it will appear, writes Wettinger, that months after Napoleon's decree, at least some of the privately owned slaves had been unable or unwilling to break their physical association with their previous owners. After all, here I'm quoting, they were often extremely well treated by them to whom they might have belonged since infancy, as in the case of Ilhalvaniya. In all probability, neither were they eager to leave their master's house, nor did they have anywhere else to go to. It is clear that the novel written, I repeat, in 1935 and not in 1800, does not take the issue of slavery seriously. One wonders why, because this is a novel that is overtly or supposedly inspired by Christian social justice. Is it because Aquilina did not consider the slaves to be, quote, Maltese? I will come back to this issue of the novel's ideas about cultural identity later on. The British flag over Malta. Across the British Empire, during the first half of the 20th century, colonized elites, articulate though embattled, began to organize cultural revivals or raised their voices in protest at imperial power. Across the colonized world, writers were speaking vehemently with new confidence about the validity of their experience. Members of small, highly educated and committed elites, they cast their message across a wide textual spectrum, producing anthropological studies, social history, and journalism, as well as poetry and fiction to promote their cause. This is what was happening in much of the British Empire at the time when José Aquilina was writing this novel. But José Aquilina takes a rather different route, as those of you who have read the novel know. In other words, in some ways, as Eleka Burma would say, his novel is a colonial novel, in the sense that it espouses some of the ideas that were promulgated by the colonial rulers. On the other hand, it is also a novel with strong nationalist sentiments, despite the British flag on the hero's idyllic house at the end of the novel. So, as many critics have noted, from the earliest times there was both resistance to and cooperation with the colonial presence. There was I wouldn't even say a love-hate relationship in the case of Aquilina. I would say that ultimately there is more of a colonial element than a decolonizing element in the novel. But on the other hand, I think it would be unfair to say that this is solely and simply a colonial novel. Even the term colonial novel is debatable and has lots of shades. The final chapter of the novel deals with the triple wedding of Alessandro and Paulina, Gianni and Esther, and their Maltese friend, De Flores, and an English woman, the widow of one of the officers of Captain Ball, who led the British forces that helped the Maltese to drive out the French forces in 1800. Her name is Mrs. Flemington. She went to church regularly and was therefore most probably a devout Catholic, not a Protestant, who also married Alessandro's Maltese friend, De Flores, in the Catholic Church. She is treated with great respect and admiration by the overt narrator and the other characters in the novel. Unlike Ilhalvaniya, she not only has a name, but she is referred to as Mrs. Flemington. There are no comments about her skin being too dark, as in the case of Ilhalvaniya. On the contrary, De Flores is enchanted by the smart widow's blue eyes, golden hair, and white skin. De Flores knows little English, but he is prepared to learn the language and asks Alessandro, Aquilina's ultimate Maltese hero, to help him because Alessandro, we are told, has been studying the language for a long time, the English language. De Flores praises the English, to please his girlfriend and future wife. But clearly, Aquilina is preparing his readers for the final pages of the novel, in which the characters put a seal on what the novel describes as the Maltese choice of the British, as the new rulers of the Maltese Islands. This is De Flores speaking in English. English good people, De Flores tells Mrs. Flemington. Captain Ball, great gentleman. Fine people, the English. Now no French, no guns, no cavalier. The novel is set at the turn of the 19th century, but Aquilina was writing 135 years after the British set foot on Malta and eventually decided to stay. But the celebration of the wedding mass for the three couples is dominated by the enchanting voice of a young woman singing the Ave Maria. Alessandro recognizes, quote, the sweet voice of Ilhalwenia Dolores, and with her new name, her second name now in a very short span of time, Sister Maria Mary. Her decision not only to convert but also to become a nun allows her to take on the name of Sister Mary, the quintessential Christian woman, whose cult is particularly strong in Catholic Malta, and also to sing the Ave Maria. Her complete conversion to Catholicism allows her to have a voice, and to use her voice, and to be listened to. The years have changed her a great deal, we are told. And, quote, you have to look at her closely to recognize her. Whereas before her face appeared dark, it now glows with the calm sweetness of a joyful soul. She has been promoted from Muslim to Christian, from darkness to light. The last reference to Ilhalwenia is on page 376 in my edition, 5 pages before the end. After the wedding mass, Alessandro immediately looked for Ilhalwenia, but she was nowhere to be seen. So people started to say that she was not an angel that took the form of a nun. So people started to say that she was an angel that took the form of a nun. And angels, I'm quoting from the novel, appear and disappear, and you cannot see them. She is promoted to sainthood. This is the third issue I wanted to deal with. Aquilina and the whole issue of cultural identity. Now, of course, my main point is that we should be reading this novel with a different concept of what identity, or different concepts of what identity is. I'm not expecting Aquilina in 1935 to have the concepts we have today. So this is more about why our reading, I think, of the novel should change, not so much an attack on Aquilina for having written what he wrote, which was, of course, his choice. The most important metaphor for the nation, yes, and I want to say something else. One thing I do not do in this paper, in this draft of a paper, is I don't compare this novel to other novels that were being written at the time, like, for example, Juan Mamo's Ulitanana Venut from America, which is in many ways very different, but in some ways quite similar in its, for example, in its rather strong prejudices against the North Africans, for example. The most important metaphor for the nation, what Kristeva has called that totally discursive being, is that of the mother. The protagonist of José Aquilina's novel compares Malta to a poor, uneducated, sick widow that is totally dedicated to her children but lacks the physical strength and the material resources to take care of them. She is in a sorry state. Malta l'aziza lif albu kini shabbah lil mara marida edha tistenna it-tabib liati as-saha. The widow is Aquilina's image of the mythicized, self-sacrificing, epic motherhood applied to the nation. The children of the nation mother have lost their father, and now, like the widow's children, they are about to lose their mother. In the novel, the arrival of the British colonial father figure, who resembles the stereotypical, self-confident male doctor of Maltese romantic historical novels, restores the health of the nation mother and reestablishes order in the nation home. In fact, at the end of the novel, the narrator points out that the newlywed protagonists have raised the English, probably meaning British, flag on the roof of their home, the ideal Maltese home. The novelist's portrayal of the metaphorical figure of the dedicated but politically ineffective nation mother is undermined by the cultural idealizations and generalizations of the maternal. Because of the conservative ideas about the Maltese nation that it promotes, both in its narrative and in its didactic passages, the two are often inseparable. The text assumes that motherhood is a universal condition, that the concept of the nation is indistinct from that of the traditional nuclear family. But in reality, motherhood, like the nation, is constructed socially and materialized within a specific set of economic and material conditions which interlock and interact with equally specific expectations and values associated with the role. To talk of the maternal in the absence of historical and social specificity is meaningless. The naturalizing language of dominant male discourse mythicizes woman as mother in order to impose on women the rigid obligation of the reproduction of the species and the role of representative of the norms of the patriarchal culture. The romantic figure of the nation mother often ignores the very diverse realities that are hidden beneath the image of the culturally constructed nation national community. This metaphor of the mother has managed to cultivate an intimacy, as Cooper would say, to foster a sense of belonging to the group. But to read the imaginary, the national imaginary, it creates as some kind of essential reality, as the writers who signed the oath at the time of the EU referendum in March 2003, would be profoundly misleading, I would say. The conventional metaphor of the nation mother lies at the heart of a series of concentric circles of metaphors of the nation that include that of the family, the home, the rural village, and the disorientation of the post-independence nation traveler. Wrong again, excuse me. The conventional metaphor of the nation mother lies at the heart of a series of concentric circles of metaphors of the nation that include that of the family, the home, and the rural village. And the disorientation of the post-independence nation traveler is caused in part by the fact that it distances itself from this oikos, from this point of reference. Like Lom Alia, the prudent mother of Duncan's sonnet, Kobet is Safar. The nation mother is associated with the land and rural culture rather than with the town or life at sea. It is linked with the family and the home rather than with the individual and adventure. Ironically, while Duncan and other romantic poets utilized metaphors of motherland and mother tongue to construct or reconstruct a national identity, they mythicized the woman and ignored the fact that women were, and I would say still are, marginalized from actual political public life, thus effectively mythicizing the concept of the nation and marginalizing it from everyday life. In an editorial entitled "What About Our National Identity?", published in the Journal of the Faculty of Arts in 1974, Aquilina put forth some of his ideas about Maltese cultural identity. He says, for example, that Malta has its cultural identity, which is clearly defined by the context of its multicultural history. He says, Our national identity is formed by our cultural heritage. Of course, he has a very vertical conception of identity, as Malouf would say. But then he also has another passage in his editorial, which comes before the ones I've just quoted. It's a short editorial, page and a half. He writes this: "We Maltese are by no means unhappy because of the new bridge between Malta and North Africa." A nice way of putting it, I would say. "The more friendly neighbors, the better. But we shall feel grievously wrong if that will ever mean the dismantling and pulling down of the older bridges that linked us with Europe, where we belong by birthright. We Maltese are the heirs of a nearly 2,000-year-old Christianity, a much older civilization than Islam. Intellectually and socially, we are also the joint heirs of the heritage of European creative scientific genius." European. "Briefly, we are as European as our friends in the free West, with whose peoples we share a common heritage." Okay, perhaps I could start moving towards the end of this paper. There's quite a lot to say, but of course, and there's quite a lot that I've chosen not to say for obvious reasons, but I think one of the big issues in the novel is that, and this becomes serious if we continue to read it the way we've read it until now, as I've shown in some of the references I've made. I think the big issue is that identity is presented in a very monolithic way. Okay. Now, like his contemporary Dunkar, Macolina adopts what one may perhaps call a colonial schema to identify Malta as a sovereign nation. Said argues that throughout the exchange between Europeans and their others, which began systematically half a millennium ago, the one idea that has scarcely varied is that there is an us and a them, each quite settled, clear, unassailably self-evident. Said finds early traces of this division in Greek thought about barbarians. By the 19th century, this kind of identity thought had become not only the hallmark, I'm quoting, of imperialist culture, but also of those cultures, including in a way the Maltese, who were trying to resist the encroachments of Europe. Looking back, this romantic, nationalistic project is understandable in its historical context, but it can no longer adequately account for the complex local and transnational realities, including the complex class divisions and tensions of today. Moreover, his is what could be called a patriarchal nationalism, a nationalism designed by men who put the woman, in this case the mother, at the center of a story that is not hers, and that she is not able or even allowed to change or influence in any significant way. It is a nationalism, I would say, rife with men, represented, in the case of Malta, by the standard term Misirietina, our forefathers. The oath is full of our forefathers. The oath, Il Halfa Tarkitibata Republika Tamalta, is full of these references to the forefathers, which expresses the limitations of this vision, and by the fact that all patriots are men, and almost all are, of course, ardent Roman Catholics. Even Manuel de Mec, this was one of the ways he defended himself, by saying, look, I am a Roman Catholic, sort of. Don't pick on me. Perhaps the most serious shortcoming of this ideal Maltese identity is its inbuilt tendency to exclude the many affiliations and allegiances that characterize Malta's checkered story. In the same way that every individual is a, I'm quoting here from Malouf. In the same way that every individual is a meeting ground for many different allegiances, and sometimes these loyalties conflict with one another and confront the person who harbors them with difficult choices, a nation or community also has a composite identity, an identity enriched, but sometimes even torn, by different religions, languages, and socio-economic groups. Some of these allegiances are linked to an ethnic past or to a religious tradition, and others are not. In each one of us, in our origins and in the course that our life has taken, there are a number of different confluences and contributions of different mixtures and influences, some of them quite subtle or even incompatible with one another. Speaking Maltese and speaking English in today's Malta, perhaps, if you want to see them as incompatible. Malta, for instance, has been strongly identified with the Catholic religion, and yet one need not be Catholic to be Maltese. And there were important phases in its history in which Malta was not Catholic. These affiliations with Catholicism and other religions and cultures are not mutually exclusive. In all necessarily complex identities, affiliations like these come together to form a unique, albeit always changing, identity, and not a solidified identity as implied in this oath. Malouf, of course, talks about vertical and horizontal identity. Each one of us, I'm coming towards the end, each one of us has two heritages, he says. A vertical one that comes to us from our ancestors, our religious community and our popular traditions, and the horizontal one transmitted to us by our contemporaries and by the age we live in. It seems to me that the latter is the more influential of the two, the horizontal one, the one we ignore, that is, and that it becomes more so every day. Yet this fact is not reflected in our perception of ourselves, and the inheritance we invoke most frequently is the vertical one. This is an essential point with regard to current concepts of identity. On the one hand, there is what we are in reality and what we are becoming as a result of cultural globalization. That is to say, beings woven out of many colored threads who share most of their points of reference, their ways of behaving and their beliefs with the vast community of their contemporaries. And on the other hand, there is what we think we are and what we claim to be, that is to say, members of one community rather than another, adherents of one faith rather than another. I do not deny the importance of our religious, national, or other affiliations, writes Malouf. I do not question the often decisive influence of our vertical heritage, but it is necessary at this point in time to draw attention to the gulf that exists between what we are and what we think we are. Although, of course, we all know that the relationship between discourse and reality is much more complex than the way Malouf may be presenting it. I was going to finish with a quote and then a reference to the oath taken by the writers in 2003, but I think I've made enough references to the oath. So I'll go straight away to this quote that complements the first quote from Chinua Achebe. This is from Seamus Dean, an Irishman. In the attempted discovery of its true identity, a community often begins with the demolition of the false stereotypes within which it has been entrapped. This is an intricate process, since the stereotypes are successful precisely because they have been interiorized, as seems to be the case both in the novel and in the oath, I would say. They are not merely impositions from the colonizer on the colonized. It is a matter of common knowledge that stereotypes are mutually generative of each other, as in the case of the English and the Brit and the Irish, and probably also in the case of the way the foreigners have seen the Maltese and the way the Maltese have seen themselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Adrian, for a fascinating and wide-ranging paper. Perhaps I can just open up the discussion by raising one question or issue. One of the many things which interested me about your paper is that, of course, Aquilina's novel is written in 1935, which we might call the High Colonial Period. And precisely because it is about a historical period in the past, it has a certain fascination for us today when we think about Maltese identity. You've pointed out the extent to which Catholicism and order are woven in to the very concept of Malta or nationhood, which Aquilina and perhaps his peers had in the High Colonial Period. And I just want to raise one possibility with you, which is this. In that long period when identities emerge, change, and evolve in the post-colony, one has to bear in mind that under colonial rule, the religion, as Jeremy Boissevin pointed out long ago in his anthropological work on Malta, the religion becomes a very central pole of identity because there are no political movements or institutions allowed by the colonial master. So religion does become very central. And so I think I want to make this point to you, namely that the Catholic religion of Southern Europe at that time had great problems with the notion of democracy. We're talking about Catholicism of the 1930s was, as a result of the legacy of Pius IX in the 19th century, monarchist, ultramontane, very anti-Catholic. So that, to a certain extent, one might argue that a Catholic Maltese identity would be inherently concerned with order and uninterested in wide-ranging representation until very recently. So that Catholicism for that period implies a rather anti-democratic and strongly pro-order approach to identity. And I think that's just one point I want to raise by way of a question.
In my thesis, I took up the issue of the role of the Catholic Church in a number of Maltese novels, written even at the time of this particular novel. This was published in the same year as Giselle Mercer's Lelita Hazzair, which is considered to be, by many people reading Maltese literature today, as a kind of revolutionary novel, as a non-conformist novel, which it is not. Because basically, the non-conformist protagonist makes his full circle and comes back to conformism. And basically, he is convinced, I would say more than we are, or many of us who have read the novel, that it was his breaking away from the order of the Catholic Church and its certainties that brought about his fall, both in sanity and in moral terms.